This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, community policing with federal dollars. How Pitch Perfect 2 hit just the right chord. Sorry about that. And what they don't want you to know in Qatar about getting ready for the World Cup. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 18th day of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The President of the United States waded into the nitty-gritty of local policing today. Item one, his Task Force on 21st Century Policing released its recommendations this morning. That was the task force set up last year. Among those recommendations, less surplus military equipment will be offered to local PDs. Item number two, in a separate announcement, more than $160 million in grants will be made to cajole police officers to follow the task force's recommendations, like buying body cameras. Also, and quite possibly not coincidentally, the White House is trying to buy itself a little bit of sway over how local police departments operate. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going.
The new grants are meant to encourage local police departments to adopt some suggestions from the White House, have officers wear body cameras, use a new federal toolkit to train them. The grants make the medicine go down a bit more smoothly, but the White House's reach is limited, according to Jack Pitney, a political scientist at Claremont McKenna College.
On a day-to-day basis, the President of the United States does not control the way police officers interact with citizens.
Money may talk, but that doesn't mean everybody's listening. Jim Pasco is executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police. He says police departments were already buying cameras, and local police will make the key decisions about how to use them.
Who'll be wearing them and for how long and under what circumstances they go on and off?
This isn't the first time President Obama has dangled money in front of local officials to try to bend them to his will.
Yeah, I think it works.
Robert Shapiro is a professor of political science at Columbia University. He points to funding for states to expand Medicaid in the Affordable Care Act.
They'll take the money, and I think it's a good case in point is what we've seen on Medicaid.
President Obama also tried to get states to change the way they educate their children with his Race to the Top grants. And he's hardly the first president to try buying a little local control. President Nixon handed out grants encouraging local police to get tough on crime. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The corporate story of this Monday is groceries, specifically groceries and big box stores. Target is planning to overhaul its grocery business to make it seem a little more, how shall I say, Target-ish. The Wall Street Journal reports the retailer is going to de-emphasize some of the big processed foods brands like Corn Flakes and Campbell's Soups and try to appeal more to consumers' growing interest in fresh, natural, and more specialty kinds of food items. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Several years ago, Target made a big push into the grocery business, the idea being that people have to buy groceries, right? So they'll show up for milk and cereal and then buy other, more expensive stuff. But Sean Naughton, an analyst with Piper Jaffray, says Target's grocery business didn't exactly soar.
In terms of the success that they've had in doing that, I would say it's been mixed so far.
To improve those results, Target wants to capitalize on new trends among consumers. They increasingly want organic foods or ones with simple ingredients that seem natural, the stuff on the periphery of the store, not the processed foods at the center. Here's Brian Yarbrough, an analyst with Edward Jones.
Natural and organics has been growing, you know, mid-teens now for, you know, 8 to 10 years. And the center of the aisle, the cereal, the chips, the cookies, the crackers, I mean, you know, they're barely growing. The soups of the world, they're barely seeing volume growth at all.
Yarbrough says it makes sense for Target to push more towards natural and organics and go after shoppers like Doug Waxon. I met him outside a high-end grocery store in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he was buying his lunch. But he says you would probably find him more frequently at Target these days.
My wife's kind of discovered recently that they're starting to carry more things that she normally gets at Whole Foods or a co-op. like some higher quality frozen lunch items and things like that. Seems like that's something that they've kind of got better at recently.
As Target markets more to those tastes, analysts say the big processed food companies are going to find less shelf space at Target unless they boost their own natural and organic offerings. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Nice enough start to the week on Wall Street today. Not too hot, not too cold, just about right. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Online education is the new thing, as you've heard here and elsewhere, MOOCs and all that. There is, however, a darker side to online education, and I'm making air quotes here. The New York Times reports today on a company in Pakistan that is getting rich to the tune of millions of dollars by selling fake educational credentials to pretty much whoever wants them. The paper's Pakistan Bureau Chief Declan Walsh has the byline. Declan, thanks for coming on.
Nice to be here.
Tell me, first of all, about this company, Exact, I guess it's called.
So Exact is a Pakistani software company based in the port city of Karachi. It has in recent years held itself out as the country's largest software exporter. It provides high salaries and unusual perks in the Pakistani context, things like a company swimming pool, there's a yacht, and so on.
It is also, it seems by this article that you wrote, what we used to call a diploma mill. It's selling higher education certificates, I guess, for not a small amount of money.
That's right. Our reporting has indicated that these websites are both posing as universities, often giving the appearance of being in the United States, or high schools, also in the United States. And their customers have been both in the United States and in many other countries around the world, particularly in the Middle East. And this has been extremely lucrative for Exact.
You got to give them credit for creativity. Some of these schools like Berkeley and Columbiana, I mean, they do get points for that.
Well, they have very cleverly and purposefully crafted the brand identity of these schools to cater to different audiences. So some of them will have names that hew very closely to those of famous American universities. Other universities will appeal to customers perhaps in the Middle East. There are universities called the American Gulf University, and so on. So within the company, these fake universities are treated as brands to be created and marketed for specific customer bases.
And marketed intensely. You write about a sales force that cold calls, they upsell with vigor.
That's right, yes. They have a whole range of techniques. It starts off with, you know, paying companies like Google and Facebook for advertising space so that, you know, if you type in a search for online education, one of their sites will come up prominently. Secondly, they have promotional tools. They place stories on the CNN iReport, which is a citizen journalism website. They create promotional videos using paid actors posing as staff and students. So they have a whole range of tools to draw people into the websites and to give them an appearance, at least, of legitimacy that allows them to maintain the fiction that these are genuine education institutions as opposed to what they are, which is actually a diploma mill.
How has it been able to thrive? Has it simply fallen through the regulatory cracks?
Well, it has very cleverly taken advantage of the sort of freedoms and anonymity that the internet can allow you to do business. It has set up a whole web of offshore companies in places like Cyprus and the British Virgin Islands to both take in the money that it receives and to pay its vendors. And it has engaged in often quite aggressive legal tactics against people who would either investigate it or criticize it in public. So newspapers and other media groups in Pakistan and in other countries, including the UK, have really come under sometimes quite strong threats from the company's in-house lawyers if they were to publish anything that was seen to, you know, to tap at this at the true nature of the company's business.
Declan Walsh, he's the Pakistan Bureau Chief for the New York Times. We got him at his base in London. Declan, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
We'll be right back. The Keystone XL pipeline gets all the press, but the fact of the matter is that there are already more than 2 million miles of pipeline out there carrying oil, natural gas, other petroleum products as well, chemicals to boot wherever they need to be. There's a fight going on over a proposed pipeline down on the Georgia coast where the company that wants to build it is asking the state to use eminent domain to let them do it. And that, as Molly Samuel reports from WABE, is going over about as well as you'd expect it to.
Eddie Reddick owns a tree farm near the South Carolina border, and he is mad.
This tree will eventually die.
We're on his family's 845-acre property in Scriven County. A few weeks ago, surveyors for the energy company Kinder Morgan came out here, and Reddick says they drove over some of his young pine trees.
See, there's a nice, vigorous growing seedling, about 7 foot tall, that's been run over.
Now that tree and others in its row are bent over sideways like long grass on a windy day. They're all pointing in the same direction toward a wooden stake with a pink ribbon fluttering at the top.
Here's the first stake, and it says proposed pipeline.
This is where the Palmetto Pipeline would travel through Reddick's land.
It continues in a southerly direction through this young pine plantation till we get to a wetland branch 700 feet on down the line.
The energy company Kinder Morgan wants to build this 360-mile pipeline along the Savannah River and then down the coast to Florida. It's split off from another bigger pipeline the company owns that carries gas from Gulf Coast refineries all the way to the Northeast. Reddick says he thinks the pipeline would take about 4.5 acres of his farm permanently out of production. That's a small amount of land for Reddick, but he says it's the principle of the thing.
As a private landowner, feel like you're being run over.
But Alan Foer says this is about planning for the larger community's needs. He's a vice president with Kinder Morgan.
We're looking at not just service now and what the needs are now in Georgia. We're trying to look at the next 20, 30 years.
Foer says right now, Savannah's fuel comes from ships or trucks. The pipeline would be cheaper and more reliable.
Savannah, in particular, is one of the few areas that doesn't have direct pipeline capacity.
It would cost about $1 billion to build the pipeline, and it eventually carry about 150,000 barrels of fuel a day. Foer says all of the gas is for domestic use, not for export. And he says Kinder Morgan will only use eminent domain where it has to.
Our use of that, if granted, is extremely rare. Over 98% of our properties are acquired by amicable resolution to the satisfaction of landowners. So we're talking about a small, very small number.
But a lot of landowners are upset about the idea. At a public hearing earlier this month, a couple hundred people turned out. There were environmentalists concerned about fragile wetlands, but the most vocal opponents, people angry about a private company taking their land.
I'm Jeff Mallard. My family's been here, my mama's people, and my daddy's people have been here since the 1700s. And I don't agree with eminent domain.
People want to say, this is my property and you can't have it.
That's Peter Appel. He's a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law.
And the fact of the matter is, that's not true.
Appel says eminent domain serves a purpose. The government uses it to build highways and post offices and parks. And yes, states can grant it to private companies too.
A pipeline similar to a railway line is almost a classic case for when eminent domain makes sense.
It makes sense, he says, because it's going to serve the public by delivering gas. And a pipeline's route isn't really that flexible. Kinder Morgan can't twist and turn around every landowner who doesn't want to sell. But Appel says just because the pipeline is a good candidate for public domain doesn't mean Georgia has to grant it.
It really is up to the government to decide, are we going to put our power behind this project?
Governor Nathan Deal came out against the plan earlier this month, but under Georgia law, it's the commissioner of the Department of Transportation who makes the decision. The deadline for that decision is tomorrow. If the commissioner gives the green light, the project will then need to go through an environmental review. In Scriven County, Georgia, I'm Molly Samuel for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's 11-hour days. The government says that in the summer months, those are only 8-hour days, but you have to work 6 days a week, and you can only take holiday once every 2 years.
Working conditions for World Cup workers in Qatar straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 26 points. Today about a 10%, closed at 18,298. The NASDAQ rose 30 points, 0.6%, 5,078. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, 0.3%, ended things at 21.29. That's a record for the Dow and the S&P if you go for that sort of thing. Corporate news courtesy of the pharmaceutical sector today. The drug maker Endo International says it's going to buy Par Pharmaceutical Holdings from Par's private equity owner TPG Capital. The new company would be in the top five of generic drug makers worldwide. Endo off 5.3% today. Traders dumped the drug maker 11 Biotherapeutics, Inc. Shares tanked 69% after the company said an eye disease drug failed a late-stage test. From the retail world, the owner of Ann Taylor and Loft, that would be Ann Incorporated, ticker symbol ANN, if you're keeping track, is going to be snapped up by a rival, the Ascena Retail Group. They run Dress Barn and Lane Bryant. Ascena shares down about 1%. Ann shares up 19%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department will release numbers on residential units under construction for the month of April. On this day in 2006, the big-screen adaptation of the best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code, debuts in theaters. And it's a good time to relax outdoors and soak up the sun, assuming there's no rain to soak you. It's National May Ray Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This weekend's movie releases feature either as unlikely a number one hit as you are ever going to see, or a film that, of course, did $70 million at the box office. Pitch Perfect 2, a movie about an all-female a cappella group, beat the big summer action movie because, well, here's Marketplace's Nova Sappho.
Traditionally, summer's big movies are targeted to boys and young men under 25.
They're just, you know, kind of knee-jerk reaction.
That's Peter Seeley. He ran the marketing department at Columbia Pictures in the late 80s. Over the weekend, though, Hollywood tradition got trounced. A 75% female audience carried Pitch Perfect 2 right past the action flick Mad Max Fury Road.
This was a huge surprise. I mean, earth-shaking. It was unprecedented.
And just went to show once again, says Seeley, that women can carry a film. From the Twilight franchise, 50 Shades of Grey and Cinderella, box office analyst Paul Der Garabedian says,
we have a lot of movies that we're seeing where women are driving the story, that they're the center of these movies, and we're just going to see more of that.
Pitch Perfect, though, hasn't just been a female-centric franchise. The first film 3 years ago has attracted a broad audience on home video, as in men, to the delight of Kay Cannon, the film's screenwriter.
Often there's like a big preamble before where there's just like, even my wife made me watch it, and none of the other channels on the television worked, and so I couldn't find the remote.
To reduce the need for a preamble this time around, Universal marketed the film broadly, even running a Super Bowl ad.
The Green Bay Packers!
What?
Yes, actual members of the Packers are in the movie at their own request. Given all the marketing efforts aimed at men, analyst Paul Der Garabedian says Pitch Perfect 2 may be able to build even more of a male audience going forward. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
We had the screenwriter Kate Cannon on last week, the day before the movie debuted. If you missed it on the radio, we've got it online. It's marketplace.org. All right, while the experts try to figure out whether that guy actually did take control of a plane by hacking into its in-flight entertainment system, there are some ground-based aviation realities that are going to be discussed in Washington tomorrow. The head of the Federal Aviation Administration is going to make an appearance before the Senate Commerce Committee, where one line of questioning is expected to be about modernizing and maybe even privatizing the air traffic control system. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has more on that.
Here's what everyone agrees on. It's time to start updating the technology used by American air traffic controllers. Sharon Pinkerton, Senior VP for Policy at Airlines for America, says replacing radar with GPS would increase efficiency.
It would enable us to put planes closer together and be more accurate in our prediction of weather and working around weather.
American skies are already some of the safest in the world, so why the sudden urgency? The FAA's budget has become a political football in Congress, and that's rattled air traffic controllers.
They want to see stable, predictable, long-range planning and funding to modernize the system.
Jim Burnley was transportation secretary under Ronald Reagan.
Their union has now made very clear in the last couple of months that it is willing to look at serious alternatives to the present structure of air traffic control.
But proposals are still vague. Some want to reform but keep the agency inside the government. Others want it privatized. Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon, the ranking Democrat on the House Transportation Committee, says the Pentagon has told him it's wary of giving airspace control to a private group, but
generally the bill's up. I mean, it's time to reauthorize the FAA. Do we want to do the same old thing, maybe try and patchwork it in place, or do we want to do something iterative and say, okay, we're going to make a major change to try and solve some of the long-term problems with this agency?
At the very least, he says, change is in the air. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
The 2022 World Cup is going to be in Qatar, over in the Middle East. The World Cup is one of those high-profile global-scale events that takes years and years and years to get ready for. Highways to be planned and laid, stadiums to be built, which means there is huge demand for labor. Qatar's been under some pressure for the way it's been treating its migrant labor force, so they arranged a tour of sorts for journalists. Among them, the BBC's Mark Lobel, which is where things went off script. Mark, it's good to have you with us.
Hi there.
Tell me how you came to be in Qatar in the first place.
We were invited in by the Prime Minister's office. They wanted to show us the improvements they'd made to workers' accommodation, specifically workers that worked on World Cup stadiums. And some of the things that we saw were incredibly impressive. For a few thousand people, they're already living in these complexes, which include lovely villas that have spacious bedrooms and privacy curtains between the beds, luxury swimming pools, and well-equipped gyms.
Except you did some further looking around, I gather, and that's when things went a little bit off the rails.
Well, that's right. We wanted to see the rest of it for ourselves so that we could put together a credible, balanced report. And we did a filming at the invitation of one worker on the Thursday night that we arrived. And then a couple of days later, as we were driving along in one of Doha's main roads, eight cars drove us off the street, and we were taken in by intelligence officers, treated like spies, if you like, and interrogated separately. The cameraman, the translator, the driver, and myself were all asked repeatedly where we had been, who we had spoken to. We were not told what we were being accused of, and then thrown into jail for the night.
This calls for a little bit of opining on your part, but it's tough not to think that they invited you in as a PR stunt, and then when you started poking around, they were not pleased.
It's difficult to tell if the same people that organized the PR side of things were responsible for the way we were trailed and then treated. I had heard rumors that there was going to be a media crackdown in the future, and that they were going to treat fair and balanced journalism, as I certainly would think of it, and I think most journalists would think of it, as a breach of national security. But the fact that we were dealt with by security officers is the beginning of what I think could be a very worrying trend unless they change policy on that.
That because the World Cup is a global event, there will surely be more of a spotlight on the treatment of migrant workers over there. Give us a sense of how they actually live day in and day out. And it's a million people, plus or minus.
Absolutely, more than a million people. We were focusing in on the Nepalese migrants, particularly because of the effect the earthquake has had on them back home and the pressures it puts on both the people there and on more people to come and work in Qatar. We met an 18-year-old who had come over in the last few months, and many of the old problems that people have been complaining about for many years existed in his case. You can't change your jobs within 5 years, which allows a huge amount of power to lie in your employer's hands. And the conditions, well, it's 11-hour days. The government says that in the summer months, those are only 8-hour days, but you have to work 6 days a week, and you can only take holiday once every 2 years.
They eventually let you go, gave you back your passport, I suppose, but they kept all your video and your recordings, right?
Well, when we were released from prison, bizarrely, we spent the day on the official media tour and interviewed the Labour minister and then went to see this new glorious accommodation. However, we were still on a travel ban for another 4 days. And as you say, all our equipment, all our footage, my phone, the cameraman's laptop, that's all still with the authorities.
Any prospect of getting it back? I imagine the BBC is having some conversations.
Well,
judging by the way that the Qatar government reacted today to this story, I don't think we're going to see it anytime soon. They've thrown more accusations our way, accusations that they didn't even make at the time against us. But what I care for more than getting our equipment back is that if this is a media crackdown, if that is what they wanted to do, crack down on the media, I just would say that's a very bad strategy, as you say, because the focus on migrant labour is only going to increase as we approach the 2022 World Cup.
Mark Lobel, the Middle East business correspondent for the BBC. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which Amazon moves one step closer to us being able to order something just by thinking it. From the pages of the Wall Street Journal, this item: people who use Amazon's voice-activated speaker system, Echo it's called, can now order something just by saying it out loud. I'd offer some thoughts here, but Amazon probably already knows what they are, right? And that is all we got. The Dow up 26 points on this Monday, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 30 points, 6 tenths percent. The S&P 500 upped itself 6 points, 3 tenths of 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.